From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 15, 2008. Iraq's parliament can't seem to pass an oil law, so the country goes ahead and opens up the oil fields to foreign investors without one. As Obama and McCain prepare for their final debate, we'll go to Canada, where early elections there favored the Conservative Party, although not enough to win a parliamentary majority. And we return to Maricopa County, Arizona today and hear from a food vendor who says he was almost deported because of his skin color. I'm Maura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A major strike affecting 27,000 aerospace workers in the U.S. has now been extended after talks between the union and Boeing representatives broke down yesterday. As it goes into its sixth week, union organizers say the strike is costing Boeing $100 million a day. Mark Taylor Canfield has more from Seattle, where the workers and their supporters are still forming picket lines.
The International Association of Machinists has announced that a new round of negotiations between the union and the Boeing Aerospace Corporation has failed to end the strike, which began 6 weeks ago. This week, the machinists were joined on the picket line by members of other unions in a show of solidarity, including airline pilots and flight crews. The machinists' union wants to protect their jobs from outsourcing to Japan. They accuse Boeing executives of pursuing personal financial gain instead of representing the best interests of the company. According to union officials, the strike by the International Association of Machinists has already cost the corporation $3.8 billion and stock values have gone down. But Boeing representatives say they can't afford to grant the concessions the union is demanding due to the high cost of doing business in a highly competitive global market. The Society of Professional Engineers in Aerospace, or SPEA, is also threatening major labor actions against Boeing after preliminary contract negotiations proved unsuccessful. SPEA is opposed to new proposed cuts to workers' wages and benefits. This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Seattle.
Russian and Georgian officials were slated to meet in Geneva today for talks to resolve their recent conflicts, but the negotiations broke down when the Russian delegation and representatives from South Ossetia and Abkhazia arrived nearly an hour late and then left the meetings early. UN officials say a procedural snag caused the problem, namely whether officials from the two breakaway regions should be present. The UN said the talks will reconvene next month. In related news, the International Court of Justice at The Hague has denied Georgia's request to prosecute Russia over its incursion into Georgian territory. The court has chosen to take a neutral stand in the conflict, but has ordered both countries to halt the violation of human rights in the region. Protests that began on Columbus Day have led to violent confrontations between indigenous people and security forces in Colombia. Over 30 indigenous people were injured in the southwestern part of the country yesterday following clashes with the army. One person has died from bullet wounds, and armed men with machetes allegedly hacked another man to death. Manuel Rueda has the latest from Bogota.
Violence broke out after the Colombian army ordered some 8,000 protesters to abandon a roadblock on a crucial stretch of the Pan-American Highway. The group included women, children, and senior citizens, members of the NASA indigenous group. When protesters refused to abandon their barricade, security forces struck with tear gas, rubber bullets, and live ammunition. Some of the protesters fought back with stones and homemade explosives. The army managed to force some off the road this morning, but community leader Jorge Arias says that protests will resume.
He says we have given the government enough time to fulfill its promises, but their lack of compromise and their intransigence has forced us to mobilize.
Several administrations have agreed to grant the NASA people land titles and reparations for massacres committed by paramilitary groups. The protesters say that President Uribe's government has not fulfilled its promises, and indigenous groups around the country have organized several demonstrations, including additional roadblocks. Colombia's national indigenous organization fears that this new wave of activism will be met with more violence. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogota.
New information has surfaced that the Bush administration explicitly endorsed the use of waterboarding during interrogation of Al-Qaeda suspects by the CIA. The Washington Post reports the administration wrote two memos in 2003 and 2004 at the request of then-CIA head George Tenet. Intelligence officials were reportedly worried leaks of the full range of techniques used would prompt a public backlash and wanted the White House's endorsement. The memos themselves have not been released. They are still classified, but both intelligence and administration officials have confirmed their contents. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Jess Burns.
Iraq's parliament has spent years wrangling over an oil law that they still haven't been able to pass, so the oil minister has started opening the prized oil fields up to foreign companies with no law in place. Tanya Snyder reports.
The U.S. State Department and transnational oil companies have been pushing the Iraqi government for years to open up its oil fields to foreign investment. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been desperate to show that he's trying in good faith to get it done, but he hasn't been able to get the oil law through the parliament. Part of the problem is the dispute over who has control over the oil in different regions of the country. Most of the oil lies in Shia and Kurdish-controlled areas. The Kurds have become so frustrated with the delays that they've started signing their own contracts with foreign oil companies. Meanwhile, the Iraqi oil minister, Hussein al-Sharistani, started trying to negotiate limited two-year technical service contracts on his own. But as Antonia Yuhas, author of The Tyranny of Oil, points out, the oil companies weren't having it.
The oil companies thought that they could do better, that they could get more out of Sharistani. And now we're seeing that come to pass with the new proposal. Instead of two-year contracts, now we've got on the table in Iraq 20-year contracts.
With some of the world's most prominent experts on oil development in Iraq, why does the country even need outside help to develop its capacity? Charlie Cray of the Center for Corporate Policy says under ideal conditions, Iraq might just need a little bit of technical support and marketing help.
If the infrastructure hadn't been the target of a lot of the attacks that were designed to basically undermine the occupation, in other words, if the occupation didn't exist, it would probably be a case where Iraq could do fine on its own.
Iraq's oil industry was fully nationalized in 1972, and surveys show strong continued support of a nationalized oil sector. Mike Eisenshur of U.S. Labor Against the War says unionized oil workers are among the principal opponents to any arrangement that would surrender control of the country's most lucrative resource.
They believe that the government should be investing in the existing national oil companies in order to build up its capacity, and then contracting. The unions are not opposed to having outside contractors for limited services, for limited duration, without any equity stake or control over the final resource, the oil.
Iraq's national oil company is currently developing 17% of Iraq's potential oil fields. What's at stake are the vast oil fields that are still unexplored, and which have the potential to be the world's largest oil supply. No one knows precisely how much oil is there. One of the sticking points with the proposed oil law is that the national oil company would be able to keep running the existing oil fields, and the vast unexplored areas would be offered on the auction block. Contracts to operate in the existing oil fields would involve a 51-49% power-sharing agreement, with the Iraqi government maintaining the controlling stake. Antonia Yuhas explains that this might be to the oil company's advantage.
That keeps it within the potential parameters of the oil law so that the oil law can still be passed. Also, I think on the ground, what you'll probably see is a lot of Iraqi oil companies, the signs of Iraqi oil companies, and not a lot of signs for Exxon, Chevron, Conoco, BP, which I would imagine would become targets for resistance.
120 companies from around the world have expressed interest in the contracts, and 35 of them qualified to bid. Contracts will be signed next year. Ben Lando, energy editor for United Press International, says the bidders are a diverse group.
They're from all over the world. They're private, you know, multinational companies. They're state oil companies, you know, run by China or Gazprom, the Russian oil and gas company that's owned by the state. So we'll see exactly who is awarded these deals.
Iraq hopes to double its current production within 4 years with the foreign investment. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
John McCain and Barack Obama will meet face-to-face tonight at New York's Hofstra University for the final debate of the presidential campaign. Both candidates have released new economic proposals this week, and the financial crisis is expected to take center stage. Both McCain and Obama focus their economic proposals on job creation. John McCain plans to create jobs through a $52 billion plan revolving around tax cuts. McCain says corporate and small business tax cuts will spur job creation, and much of his plan focuses on retirees, a reliable voting bloc. In his plan, McCain proposes to cut taxes when withdrawing from retirement accounts and cut taxes on the sale of stocks and bonds, also known as the capital gains tax. McCain's plan also includes relief for the unemployed. Here's McCain at a campaign stop in Pennsylvania Tuesday.
I'm also proposing today that for those who are between jobs, we eliminate all taxes on unemployment benefits.
Obama laid out his economic stimulus plan Monday. His proposal would place a 90-day moratorium on home foreclosures, cut taxes for companies that create U.S.-based jobs, and allow people to prematurely make withdrawals from their retirement accounts without a penalty. Obama will likely highlight his $60 billion plan tonight. The third-party candidates were not invited to the debate. Independent candidate Ralph Nader will also be in New York. He'll be speaking at New York City's Cooper Union. Canadians went to the polls yesterday in the first political test of a G7 nation's government since the start of the global financial meltdown. The ruling Conservative Party saw an overall increase in support. Having won most of the seats, the Conservatives will once again form the government. But with four parties represented in the parliament, those gains weren't enough to win them the majority of seats. From Toronto, Kristen Schwartz brings us this wrap-up of issues and results.
It was supposed to be a conservative majority. There was no doubt that's what Prime Minister Stephen Harper wanted when he dissolved Parliament and called a snap election 38 days ago. The largest opposition party, the Liberals, were languishing under an unpopular leader and trailing in the polls. In Quebec, the nationalist Bloc Québécois appeared weaker than ever before. Last night, those hopes for a majority were dashed. Yes, the Liberals performed poorly, as predicted. But the Bloc Québécois performed better than predicted and took two-thirds of seats in Quebec, home to one-quarter of Canada's population. FSRN caught up with political commentator Judy Rebick, where she teaches at Ryerson University, to explain how Harper miscalculated.
He had two policies which finished him in Quebec. One was to cut public funding to culture. And culture is central in Quebec. And then the second thing is he has this horrible position of 14-year-olds being tried as adults. You know, if the 14-year-old is convicted of murder, that he'd be sent to prison for life. And Quebec has the most progressive justice system in North America, and people are very proud of that.
That long-time political and cultural divide between Quebec and the rest of Canada proved to be more significant in this election campaign than the financial crisis. Last week, as the stock market and the Canadian dollar plummeted, support for the Conservatives in the polls also fell by several points. But the Conservative numbers crept back up over the weekend amid rosy assessments of Canada's economic fundamentals. Still, Canada has lost 400,000 jobs in manufacturing and forestry over the past 5 years, and many Canadian families are feeling the pinch. Kelly Hayes is the Ontario director of the Canadian Labour Congress, which helped the left-of-centre New Democratic Party pick up several seats in areas hard hit by those job losses.
Hopefully, the other three parties can make enough noise at Parliament to have Stephen Harper recognize that, yeah, we do have a crisis here, and it's more than what he is saying.
An interesting development in this election campaign was the unprecedented debate about how to address climate change. the Liberal Party proposed a shift from taxing income to increases in taxes on use of fossil fuels, known as carbon taxes. The Green Party proposed its own carbon tax measure, and while no Greens were elected, the party won almost 8% of the popular vote. Dan McDermott, director of the Ontario chapter of the Sierra Club of Canada, describes the Conservative position.
Well, we're hoping that Stephen Harper's transition on the subject of climate change will continue. He's gone from being a climate change denier to at least acknowledging its reality. A lot, of course, is going to depend upon what happens globally. And with changes likely in the United States with their coming election, it may be that Canada has to play catch-up to get on a level playing field with the United States before long.
Canada's divisions on regional and political lines have resulted in three minority governments and three federal elections in just 4 years. No party is excited about another election in the near future, and neither are the voters. Only 59% of eligible voters cast a ballot in this election, the lowest voter turnout in a federal contest in Canadian history. This reluctance to go to the polls yet again may well allow the Conservatives to act like a majority government, even though they came away from this election with less than half the total seats and just under 38% of the popular vote. From Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
We continue our series on Maricopa County, Arizona today, where a battle is intensifying between Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who has served for 16 years and is seeking re-election come November, and activists who say Arpaio is using hate and racial profiling to divide a community. For the past 2 years, Arpaio's local deputies have enforced federal immigration law under an agreement with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, called 287G. But people in Maricopa County say that 287G has now become a pretext for deputies to target and harass anyone with brown skin, regardless of their immigration status. And it's not just activists and organizers who allege that Arpaio has infringed on people's civil rights. Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon is so disturbed by Sheriff Arpaio's tactics that he's personally written two letters to the FBI demanding an investigation into what he says is discriminatory harassment, improper stops, searches, and arrests. David J. Ramirez is the deputy director for the City of Phoenix Public Information Office. He says Arpaio's so-called crime suppression sweeps are one of the reasons why Mayor Gordon is demanding an FBI investigation into Sheriff Arpaio's activities.
The sheriff is well known for conducting sweeps. It's where he targets a neighborhood and then basically looks for anyone, particularly of brown skin, to detain if he or she has run a red light, if they have a broken tail light, and that they're hauled off or they're detained without being given their rights. This is simply not constitutional. It is not American. And no one seems to want to confront the sheriff about this. And the mayor made it very clear that he believes this is unconstitutional and illegal.
In his letter to Attorney General Michael Mukasey, Mayor Gordon writes, quote, Sheriff Arpaio's actions have infringed on the civil rights of our residents, unquote. Gordon cites several statutes that he says Arpaio is likely violating, including a section of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But Sheriff Arpaio is certainly not worried.
It's not bothering me. I was a high Justice Department official. By the time they get me here, I'll be dead and buried anyway.
Arpaio seems unmoved by the mayor's request for a civil rights investigation of his department. He says the charges are unfounded.
I'm not losing any sleep. Where are they? I don't see any investigation, regardless of what the rumors may be. No, I'd feel very comfortable. We did nothing wrong.
Try telling that to Roberto Limas. Limas is a food vendor who spends his day earning a living to support his family in Phoenix's parks. Couples, children, soccer players, just about everyone stops by his cart to buy a corn on a stick and other cheap snacks. In July, sheriff deputies demanded to see his food handler permit and then his driver's license and finally his insurance and registration, despite the fact he wasn't driving at the time. Limas knew all his permits were in order and he produced everything they demanded, but once they asked what his nationality was, he demanded to see a lawyer. That's when deputies cuffed him while they waited for backup. Limas explains.
I didn't answer them. I told them I wanted to talk to a lawyer. The deputy asked me about 4 times, "Where are you from?" I told him I didn't want to talk to him, that I wanted to talk to a lawyer. Then, at that moment, he got mad, and he told the other deputy, "Arrest him," he said, and he arrested me. They arrested me right here. And half an hour later, a car arrived. I think it was their boss's, and he showed him all my documents, all my permits. And in about 5 minutes, he said, "Let him go." And he let me go. He left me. He told me, "Get out of there."
Lima says his rights were violated when deputies harassed him and asked him about his nationality, and maintains that happened simply because he's brown. Limas believes Sheriff Arpaio uses his leadership to promote racist policies throughout Maricopa County.
It's racism that's here, on his part. That's what I think. He acts against us. Because we've seen a lot of things. We've seen that was a raid on food vendors. I think it's racism.
Not surprisingly, Sheriff Arpaio disagrees.
Well, that's wrong. You talk to these people and they always give you the wrong story. We went and we arrested, I believe, 12 vendors, number one, for health violations. So whether you're here legally or illegally, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We seized the carts, the food. It was, you know, there wasn't nice food. They just so happened to be illegal. 11 out of 11 were illegal. But we were there not for that reason. We were there to enforce the permit and to enforce the health problems, which are health problems when they're selling food, milk, and everything else that do not pass the criteria. So when he says he was detained, well, there may be a reason for it. Maybe his corn had too many flies on it. So we were looking at the health problems.
But why do you think the question of his nationality, because in the end it wasn't a problem. They didn't ever actually arrest him. They just detained him. They either flexi-cuffed him or handcuffed him. And he was pretty angry because he was saying, "What does my nationality have anything to do with it?"
Well, we don't ask for passports or papers. We may ask for his driver's license or permit to operate, which we can do. I don't care who he is. We want his permit. As far as his allegations, I can't comment because I don't know what the situation was that, if it's true, caused the deputies to ask those questions.
Limas, the food vendor, was never formally arrested, much less deported, only questioned about his nationality while cuffed. The sheriff's office says the health division of the Environmental Services Department demanded they check the permits for all corn vendors, a claim the health division denies. The division told FSRN that although they have had communication with local law enforcement about keeping an eye out on health inspectors while they conduct routine health code checks, Sheriff Arpaio was never contacted to carry out any kind of operation. The FBI, meanwhile, acknowledged to FSRN that they are aware of the 2 letters that Mayor Gordon wrote demanding a civil rights investigation into Sheriff Arpaio's department. They add that no formal investigation has opened because no individuals have come forward, although the mayor's letter cites several specific incidents. You can see copies of these 2 letters on our website, fsrn.org. Tune back in tomorrow when we'll go to the town of Guadalupe, a place some residents say is ground zero in the national immigration debate. Last April, Sheriff Arpaio used deputies in cars and on horseback, as well as helicopters, to conduct a massive raid in Guadalupe, a tiny 1-square-mile town mostly populated by brown people, and about half of them are Yaqui natives with historic ties to the land, not undocumented immigrants. That's tomorrow on FSRN. A technical study released on Friday by the Federal Communications Commission has seemingly debunked arguments against utilizing white spaces, that's the unused channels between television signals to expand broadband internet access. On one side of the debate are telecommunications companies that market services for handheld wireless devices, digital television broadcasters, and wireless microphone manufacturers who argue that new users will interfere with their existing signals. But white space advocates say that opening up the spectrum will allow owners of certain wireless devices to access the internet for free via public airwaves. Christine Lewis reports from New York City.
There is a lot of talk these days about the digital divide and solutions to reducing it so that low-income communities are not shut out of the gains this technology brings. Most programs focus on bringing cheap computers to poor households or subsidizing internet service. Stuart Overby, a spokesperson for Motorola, says allowing the public to use new devices on the white space spectrum would have a much bigger impact on low-income communities who lack high-speed internet connection in their homes. He spoke at a recent hearing on the issue at New York City Council.
This is a practical way to protect important operations currently in the ban and at the same time open unused TV white space spectrum to help bring broadband to all Americans across the country, help make the industries more competitive, and use the limited spectrum resources more effectively.
Proponents believe that the new users could peacefully coexist with the old users. But David Donovan, who represents corporate broadcasters, painted a scary picture of the devices in his testimony at the hearing.
The interference are significant. They will come from your neighbors. They could come down the street. You won't know where that interference is coming from.
Lining up with corporate broadcasters is New York's theater industry. A city council resolution sponsored by council member Gail Brewer and Speaker Christine Quinn urges the FCC to refrain from certifying white space devices. The resolution claims such devices would be devastating to the city's theaters, which currently use open TV channels for their wireless microphones. Lori Baskin is director of government and education programs, a theater communications group representing not-for-profit theaters.
We would just like to see the FCC continue to do enough testing to make sure that any new devices that are going to be permitted into the white spaces would not interfere with the wireless microphone technology in use in all of the performing arts.
Dharma Daly, research director for the Ethos Group, and a resident of upstate New York, urged the council to balance Broadway's interests with the need of rural areas where there is an abundance of potentially useful airwaves.
Only 38% of rural Americans have broadband service right now. And part of that is not just that they can't afford it, which is an issue, but also that it's not available.
The FCC recently conducted additional field tests of prototype white space devices on Broadway and at an NFL football game to ensure that they would not interfere with wireless microphone systems. All sides eagerly await the results and the FCC final decision in the coming weeks. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I am Christine Lewis with Community News Production Institute.
Christine Lewis is a member of the Community News Production Institute. Disclaimer, their parent organization, People's Production House, supports public access to the white space spectrum. And that will do it for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.